In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies. It is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. You know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
I'm Andrew Gold, a fallen BBC journalist interviewing the heretics and rebels brave enough to speak out against mainstream narratives. Here's Coleman Hughes, John Ronson, and the Trigonometry podcast guys bringing controversy to the fore.
How'd you feel if a person of a different race moved in next door?
I spent a while with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan.
The system punishes people for wrongthink. It's heartbreaking.
Here's My Unorthodox Life Netflix star Julia Hart on getting out of a Hasidic Jewish cult.
Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is.
And biologist Richard Dawkins on trans activism.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, I am a man, but I feel feminine. But to then say, therefore I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language.
Now it's your turn. Rebel against the mainstream and find a home in this sensible alternative space by subscribing to Heretics Podcast.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
On this episode of Conspiracy Unlimited, two well-known Princeton alumni at last reveal the true inside story of how they got caught up in and nearly done in by the CIA's LSD-laced deep hypnosis research while they were Princeton students in the late 1960s.
Under hypnosis, they would play with me in terms of having me become other people. I think once they turned me into Bob Dylan for a few hours, once they turned me into George Harrison, I was walking around the Institute as George Harrison. I mean, out of my mind. I was under hypnotic condition. You don't remember it. It's very real to you when you're experiencing it.
This episode is brought to you by Logo Creator 7 Software. These days, it's more important than ever to have a good image, especially if you have a small business or you sell stuff online or even post on social media. But quality graphics can cost money, and advanced software like Photoshop can take time to learn. That's why I want to tell you about some amazing piece of software called Creator 7. Creator 7 is so easy to use, yet it lets you create super-looking logos, business cards, character mascots, you name it, in just minutes. Whatever you create is going to look super cool and impressive. Creator 7 comes with hundreds of ready-made templates. Just click and drag to make changes, and instantly you have really impressive graphics right on your computer. Now, some clever folks have ordered the Creator 7 software to start their own logo-making business, creating and selling logos and graphics for a profit. That's how good it is. But you won't believe the price. Creator 7 creates beautiful logos and designs right on your computer and works on either PC or Mac. And right now, it's available at an amazing price. To see it in action, just visit radioshowlogo.com. That's radioshowlogo.com. radioshowlogo.com.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serres. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard Serres.
I hope wherever you are, you're well. Hope you're managing to avoid the flu and some of these nasty viruses that circulate this time of year. Now, I tell you, one of the benefits of homeschooling is that my little guys are not in close quarters with other children for 8 hours a day. I don't mean to say they don't get to play with other children. Here come the emails. You homeschoolers are horrible parents. You don't let your children associate with other kids in public schools. No. My boys are very well socialized. They have organized play days and they play hockey and tennis with other children. But the point is, since we removed them from public school, they just don't get sick anymore. And as a result, neither do I, or the mighty Aphrodite. But I'll tell you, in previous years, I used to get terrible colds because of, mutated viruses our children would bring home. And I remember one winter, I had a terrible cold. And my sister, who's a nurse, offered me some cold medication. It's called Cold Effects. I'm sure it's great stuff. People swear by it. I don't know if it helped my cold. But I'll tell you what happened. That night, after I took Cold Effects, I suffered a horrible panic attack. Lying in bed, and I felt the room was closing in on me, and I couldn't breathe, and my heart was pounding, and I had to leave the house at like 2 o'clock in the morning in my pajamas in the middle of a snowstorm. There I was on the driveway, doubled over, taking deep breaths until this panic attack subsided. So the point is, I don't do well on medication or drugs, never have. So I can't imagine taking LSD. I can't imagine, even micro doses. But Paul Jeffrey Davids and his colleague and co-author John Selby did exactly that back in the late 1960s while they were attending Princeton University. Unknowingly, they were involved in a CIA-sponsored mind control experiment. And that's where we're going for the next 40 minutes or so. Paul is the co-author of 6 Star Wars books for Lucasfilm. He was production coordinator and a writer of the original animated Transformers TV series. Executive producer of Showtime's Roswell, the UFO cover-up, and he's produced and directed 10 feature films, including The Sci-Fi Boys and The Life After Death Project, and also the biopic Timothy Leary's Dead. He's also an accomplished artist and a pretty fine magician. Paul Davids, welcome to Conspiracy Unlimited. How are you?
Richard, I'm feeling fine, and I think it's going to be very unlimited tonight.
Blowing America's mind. First of all, the title actually lifted from a headline from the 1977 edition of the Los Angeles Times. Explain.
That's right. In 1977, the CIA's secret mind control project, MKUltra, which was actually about 150 projects, it was exposed for the first time. And there were a lot of editorials and write-ups, reports, and opinions about what was discovered then. And the Los Angeles Times had an editorial with the headline, "The CIA Blowing America's Mind." Well, my co-author on this book, which takes that name, Blowing America's Mind, My co-author, John Selby, and I had been looking for the right title for this book for many, many, many years. I think we tried 20 different titles, and it was John Selby who finally said, that's our title, Blowing America's Mind.
And the import of that headline, explain how, the quote, once again, this nation confronts how to prevent its powerful secret intelligence agency from becoming a threat to the very freedoms they were established to protect.
Well, what was discovered in 1977 and what shocked John Selby and I so much at that point, we had been, while we were students at Princeton in the late 1960s, volunteers at the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute, which was experimenting then in deep hypnosis and LSD research, psychedelic research. And at that time, we had no idea that a substantial part of the funding came from the CIA, or that what we were participating in was part of MKUltra. We learned it about 10 years later when MKUltra was exposed for the first time, and the doctors in our program were mentioned, and specifically the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute, which was in Skillman, New Jersey, a short drive from Princeton. We were both psychology majors at the time. It was an absolutely fascinating project, and we decided soon after that we just had to tell our story. We had to record it, write it, preserve it for posterity. But Richard, it has just taken decades, half a lifetime or more, for us to complete the book and then finally decide it was safe to come out with it. But it's a very personal account of what actually happened to us when we were there and what Princeton was like at that time, you know, one of the greatest universities in the nation. It was still an all-male school.
I hadn't realized that until I read this, that it didn't go co-ed until, just shortly after you graduated.
I graduated in 1969, and in the fall of 1969, women were admitted for the first time. The texture of Princeton has just changed completely since we were there. And one of the things that our book does is to capture the flavor of that all-male institution. You know, the ambience of it is so much of what was important to us. Richard, I want to compare it for a moment to another book about the 1960s, which has become one of the classics, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe.
Yes,
do you know
yes.
that book?
Oh, of course. Required reading in college.
It is. And it's the story of what happened to Ken Kesey, who
yes.
was the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
From the Merry Pranksters.
Yes, and John Selby and I always felt that our experience at the New Jersey Neuropsych Institute was very much like a real-life One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I want to tell you about the psychiatrists who ran the program and what they were doing to us and what their goals were and all of that. But one of the things that Tom Wolfe said, because he didn't live the travels with Ken Kesey in the bus that they called further, the psychedelic bus, back when Ken Kesey was giving out acid and Kool-Aid throughout the country,
right?
Just about 2 years before LSD was declared illegal in 1966.
Right.
Tom Wolfe said that what was so important to him was to give the flavor of it all of those times as if you were really living it. And of course, we can relive it today through that book. My goal and John Selby's goal for Blowing America's Mind was very, very similar. We wanted to put you inside our skin in the late 1960s and have you live this with us. It was by no means a smooth ride. I mean, we discovered the psychedelics through the New Jersey Neuropsych Institute. We were sort of under the wing of a very famous pioneer in that field.
Dr. Humphrey Osmond.
Humphrey Osmond, who came from Saskatchewan, Canada, originally England.
Right, right.
But he had been practicing with, I think, Albert Hoffer in Saskatchewan. And as early as the early 1950s, he had discovered the psychedelics. He took peyote with Native Americans up there and wrote about it. He began to study the similarities between the schizophrenic mind states and the dissimilarities between madness and the psychedelic state of consciousness.
Didn't he, in fact, coin the term psychedelic?
It's his invention, psychedelic. In fact, you know, he came to the United States and he set up shop at the New Jersey Neuropsychiatric Institute. He ran the Bureau of Research there. And he befriended the great philosopher, writer, Aldous Huxley, who is probably most famous for the book The Brave New World. And he is the one that persuaded Aldous Huxley to try mescaline, which is the active ingredient of peyote, and to be guided on a psychedelic trip. And then Huxley wrote the book The Doors of Perception.
Right. He called it Soma, right?
Well, there's a debate about what Soma was in ancient times. Soma was the legendary holy sacrament drug that goes back to the days of the early Hindus. Yes, and in Brave New World, he took that term, mm-hmm. Soma, and used that. From his book, The Doors of Perception, well, that's where the group, the rock group, The Doors, gets its name.
He
felt like it was opening the doors of his mind, that he was beholding the world fresh, like a newborn. And his book was extremely influential, and this was before college students, it was before the hippies, it was before the spread of psychedelics, which spread like wildfire and created what we call the psychedelic movement of the late 1960s, which had its high points and its disastrous points. But John Selby and I were caught right in the middle of it in that academic environment with the man who was at the beginning and center of that research. And then also Timothy Leary came into the picture.
Sure.
I filmed a biography of Timothy Leary.
That's right.
Called Timothy Leary's Dead. It was really big at the Toronto Film Festival mm-hmm. 1 year. So I got to know Leary later, but at that time it was Osmond and his partner, Bernard Aronson, Bernie Aronson, who was a psychologist, a master hypnotist. And they were enlisting college students and some who were not in school to be paid a small salary to come into the Institute a couple times a week and undergo deep hypnosis. And what they advertised it was going to be and what it turned out to be were two completely different things. And our discovery of that and our experience of it and the tremendous psychological anguish that my partner, John Selby, went through as a result of it are all there in Blowing America's Mind.
And we should point out that the hypnosis sessions were mingled with micro doses of LSD.
Sometimes they were, yes. Not every session, but sometimes they were. And I would never know when or when it was or when it wasn't.
Did you and Selby know each other prior, or did you actually meet as part of the experiment?
We met as part of the experiment. He was a Princeton student, a little older than I was, and he had been a hypnotic subject for a year before I got involved. And they were talking then about elevating him to be a staff hypnotist. You know, a great concern of college students at that time was the military draft. It was compulsory. And it was when the Vietnam War was really heating up. John Selby had no interest in becoming a military man. And it was held out to him that if he took a job as a full-time hypnotist at the Institute the following year, that he would be given a military deferment, or Bernie could get him a military deferment from the draft on the basis that the work they were doing was in the national interest. Well, this should have raised some questions
right.
and alarms for us then. I mean, why was it in the national interest?
Exactly.
The manipulations that were involved in this hypnosis actually became pretty frightening. It was really a two-edged sword, Richard. I don't want to paint it as all dark, because it wasn't.
What was Dr. Osmond and his team trying to achieve with these experiments? What was the whole point of it?
These men were really interested in cataloging the perceptual differences between schizophrenia, madness, as they say, and the psychedelic state, which they often describe as expanded consciousness, expanded awareness of the senses. And they found that by manipulating our perceptions of things like time, depth perception, space, our size, taking us through out-of-body experiences using hypnosis, they studied the behavior that they instilled in us and felt that they were learning about more about schizophrenia through artificially inducing those states and learning more about what they called hypnotic analogs to the psychedelic state.
I am curious about the hypnosis sessions because typically in hypnosis there are, you know, there are supposed to be strict protocols, and I get the sense that maybe those were being violated while you were under hypnosis.
Well, they had their own protocols, and they included extensive memory erasure of what happened during the conditions, and they were supposed to restore memory of everything at the end after you'd gone through months of deep hypnosis. And part of what comes out in the book is how John Selby, especially, because he'd been at it much longer and more deeply than I had, felt that there was never a complete erasure of conditions that he was under. And because of that, would have flashbacks from them. And one of the effects of those was the fact that he was a champion Ivy League fencer.
Right.
And he found that the effect of that on his fencing was catastrophic. And he had been, I think, number four in the nation as a fencer up to a certain point. And then things collapsed. And it was very connected to what was going on at the Institute. At the same time, LSD was becoming popular on the Princeton campus, and so was marijuana. The laws in New Jersey at that time were very, very, very strict on marijuana.
Oh, in many parts of the country. Dr. Timothy Leary was threatened with 10 years in prison for possession of a single joint.
It's absolutely frightening when you look at it, and I want to talk about how the world, has changed and how it hasn't changed today. But I mentioned Ken Kesey before, who was one of the very promising American novelists at that time. I mean, I think he was in his mid-20s when he wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote Sometimes a Great Notion. And LSD was legal back then, up until 1964. But the feds went after him on marijuana possession, and they got him twice on that, and he faced years in prison. I think because they got him twice, he faced 5 years in prison. And he fled to Mexico. Eventually, he snuck back into the United States, and he was captured, and he went through the whole legal process. There were multiple trials against him. And we're talking about simple possession, Richard. For many of us today, by today's standards, it's inconceivable the extent of persecution over marijuana. And in the United States, I think in 29 states now, it's legal for medical purposes. In some of the states, it's simply legal, period. In other states, it's still prosecuted. And in the federal books, it's still a class one drug.
Unbelievable.
No distinct.
Right.
No distinction from heroin. And, you've got to ask yourself, you talk about schizophrenia. Hmm. Let's talk about sociological schizophrenia.
Well, it was only maybe 100 years ago where doctors come to the house with their little black bag, and in all of those little black bags was a vial of cannabis oil. It was seen as a cure-all.
Sure. And as we look at the history of the persecution now, we know that protecting the cotton industry had a lot to do with the votes to make marijuana illegal in the first place. And it was also convenient for suppressing certain populations that were suppressed. You know, the black population, the Latino population tended to smoke that, use it more than the whites. But, you know, back in those days, and it was a device of keeping people under control, let's say. But the fact that the laws federally haven't changed, and yet much of the country is living in a different world from that, it, in my opinion here, this is, you know, my feeling, this has to be addressed and changed, because it creates such an incredible disrespect for the law itself. It's not respected, and again, it's just opinion. It's wrong. It's wrong. We're living in this completely dysfunctional society. You know, a house that wars with itself cannot stand. Isn't that the saying?
Well, the war on drugs is declared by Nixon has been an abject failure, beyond a miserable failure. Paul Jeffrey David's my guest, the co-author of Blowing America's Mind. You know what else blows my mind? Pear Networks. If you're looking for world-class website hosting at a fair price, there's a company I want to tell you about, Pear Networks. Pear Networks hosts hundreds of thousands of websites. And why do I recommend them? Simply because they set the standard for excellence with a technical support staff that's second to none. Their support team responds so quickly, and they always give straight answers, and that's important. Plus, they have top-of-the-line technology. That's why Pear Networks offers total reliability for your website with a money-back guarantee. So whether you're a professional web designer, a busy web marketer, or you're just getting a site online, Pear Networks has a website hosting plan that's right for you. Log on and learn more at pear.com. Let me spell it out for you. PAIR.com. PAIR.com. Pear Networks.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, One Strange Thing presents forgotten stories from America's newspaper archives. They all have something in common, a single element that can't quite be explained. Join us on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a man who was literally stricken with genius. A 21st century child who remembered piloting a World War II bomber. A mysterious, unidentifiable blob in Texas. And then there was the lizard man stalking through small-town South Carolina. From cryptids and disappearances to modern-day miracles, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now, wherever you listen.
Every town has a dark side. This is Andrew Fitzgerald from the Every Town podcast, where every single week we dive into insane and mysterious true crime stories, most of which you've never heard of. Stories like the bizarre disappearance of Tyler Davis in Columbus, Ohio, a 29-year-old father trying to find his way back to his hotel when he disappeared and was never heard from again, and Elizabeth Schoaf from Lugoff, South Carolina, who was abducted from her driveway by a madman and taken to his underground bunker in the woods. And we give you all the details you're interested in hearing about without any fluff or fillers, because ain't nobody got time for that. We cover everything from psychopaths to poltergeists, so go check out the Every Town podcast, because every town, no matter how nice it may seem, has a dark side.
If there's one thing money can't buy, it's sanity. Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
Paul Jeffrey David's my guest, the co-author of Blowing America's Mind. It was interesting you mentioned Selby's experience, and certainly one of the negative impacts was that it impaired his memory. And later it was shown that that was one of the, I guess, one of the purposes of MK Ultra was that the U.S. intelligence groups could then go to retired agents and erase certain parts of their memories in order to protect, I guess, state secrets.
It was one of their goals.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of old clippings in the book that document even the headline from the New York Times where the CIA tells Columbia and Princeton of the secret behavioral research that was going on in their universities that the administrators may not have known about.
Paul, when did various intelligence groups first become interested in hallucinogens?
It was really early in the discovery of those drugs in the Western world that the CIA came in with an intense interest. And it all happened very slowly. I mean, for a very long time, it was considered just a myth that there were these magic mushrooms in Mexico, because those who knew about the mushrooms weren't revealing them to, you know, they weren't disseminating the information. It was largely kept secret. A man named Gordon Wasson first experienced the mushrooms in Mexico, the word began to trickle out from him. LSD, discovered by Albert Hoffman in Switzerland. He's also the one who later decoded the chemical structure of psilocybin, the active ingredient in the magic mushrooms. But in the early 1950s, when Humphrey Osmond was getting involved in this research, the government was looking at this for the first time, certainly LSD. And they wondered, you know, would it be useful as a truth serum? Or would it be, you know, would it be useful to break people down? I mean, it was all the dark, the negative, the military aspects of using it for manipulation, which is, I don't know if the right word is tragic, but many books have been written showing that these psychedelic drugs, it means mind manifesting, they are used as sacraments in certain religions. They have been for years. And the peyote, the flesh of the gods, it's called. And the feeling that the elevation of consciousness that can come in some experiences under the right circumstances from the psychedelic drugs, that these open the mind and bring on a kind of mystical sense of oneness that opens up many people to what they feel is a religious experience, let's say.
Sure. And you speak of microdosing. There's been a bit of a resurgence in that, and it is being shown now to incredible things with combating depression.
And they're studying the use of psychedelics to aid people who are in hospice, let's say.
Yes. Yes, end of
people who don't have long to live.
End of life anxiety. Yes, UCLA.
I was going to say Aldous Huxley went out on LSD, which is something Timothy Leary talked about in the film I made on him. And for those too young to remember, he was massively influential back in the 1960s in proselytizing LSD and the psychedelics. And the proselytizing that brought it out into the open and soon resulted in its spreading so that millions of people were having these experiences. This was something I think the literature shows that the CIA absolutely never intended, or never wanted. You know, this was to be a secret among the elite. But Leary was the one that set it loose on the rabble, let's say. And then there was Owsley. His full name was Augustus Owsley Stanley. And he introduced himself to Ken Kesey, expecting Kesey to know him because he was the manufacturer of millions of tabs of LSD. He was the biggest supplier of acid in the world at that time, much more than Sandoz, the company that manufactured it in Europe and released it only really for experimental purposes. But Owsley disseminated it widely. He was the grandson of a senator from Kentucky. And he was the founder of the Grateful Dead.
Ah, all right.
So you know the term acid rock.
Yes, yes.
Okay. It all begins with Owsley and the Grateful Dead, and then you get acid rock. So these were all characteristics of the 60s at the time that John Selby and I were so naively entrusting our our very selves to Bernie Aronson and Humphrey Osmond at the New Jersey Neuropsych Institute.
So why did your co-author, John Selby, end up falling out with the Institute? He quit. He quit the program. Why?
Well, everything he was going through led him to a tremendous psychological crisis. I mean, they were manipulating everything in his life, including his relationship with his girlfriend. I mean, there is this underlying theme of the homosexuality, let's say the homosexual tastes of one of the doctors at the Institute, who was manipulating Selby and, you know, trying to destroy his relationship with his girlfriend. And, you know, he came to well, on the one hand, it was almost like a crack up or a breakdown. But on the other hand, he came to realize the dark aspects of the Institute and what they were doing to him. And the fact that the Institute, at a time where LSD had been illegal at that point, and officially, I think, officially, LSD research had been shut down by 1967, 68, thereabouts. But they still had a lot of acid at the Institute.
Could I just jump in and could you maybe compare Dr. Timothy Leary's work with Dr. Humphrey Osmond? Because it sounds like Osmond had a direct channel with CIA, certainly the funding.
I think Leary did too, by the way. I don't doubt it. I don't doubt that he had his company connections and then double-crossed them. And then they went after him with a vengeance when he went his own way. I'll get back to Timothy Leary in a moment, but I think one of the interesting things about the origin of this book, which took us decades to write, I mean, we started it a few years after we were in college. I was a student at the American Film Institute's Center for Advanced Film Studies. And I began writing this with John Selby, and I had hoped that this would be my first film project after the center. It wasn't. It fell by the wayside. I've made 10 other movies. This thing waited decades. We just couldn't finish it. And, you know, as we were finishing at Princeton, we had a break between us. John Selby and I, we didn't talk to each other for a couple of years because I was still pro-Institute, let's say. And he had warned me to get out of there, and I hadn't listened to him. So it took a couple years for me to have sort of a change of heart and get back together with him and really force him to tell his story, to get it written, and in the process tell mine and then put the two of them together.
Why didn't you see what he saw? Was it because you had entirely different experiences, or were you being maybe naive?
I was naive, and it was earlier in the process for me. I hadn't gone through some of the really negative and scary hypnotic conditions yet at that point. And I was just sort of a believer in the Institute's research. I didn't see the negative side of it. I certainly didn't know about the CIA connection at that point.
So while you were microdosing LSD as part of the experiment at Princeton, did you have a particularly profound or transcendental experience that you could share with me?
I don't know that it was transcendental, but he, you know, under hypnosis, they would play with me in terms of having me become other people. I think once they turned me into Bob Dylan for a few hours, once they turned me into George Harrison, which is in the book, you know, that I was walking around the Institute as George Harrison. I mean, out of my mind, I was under hypnotic condition. You don't remember it. It's very real to you when you're experiencing it. And then they have memory erasure. They have trigger words. They train you for quite a period of time to have a certain, it might be a nonsense word or term, that becomes your trigger for very quickly going under hypnosis.
And did you ever figure out yours or John's trigger word?
I think for John Selby, his trigger word, we figured out when we learned what it was something from the James Joyce book Ulysses. Anyway, but transcendental. I mean, there were times when I had the equivalent of the psychedelic experience through deep hypnosis. Sometimes it was augmented by a very, very small dose of LSD. That use of the very small dose of LSD, I think you mentioned it's becoming popular in Silicon Valley. It's very interesting that Steve Jobs credited LSD, his experience with that, as having opened his mind to be able to make many of the advances that he did that have helped change the world.
I have no doubt that there is an upside to microdosing, unleashing creativity and so forth.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries? Or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive?
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator?
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you, now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Lincoln County 911.
There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to get back to something you mentioned about trigger words and hypnosis. Let me just ask you, now, based on what you went through and what you now know about MKUltra,
yeah,
do you think it's possible using hypnosis, perhaps, maybe not micro dosing, maybe, massive doses, but do you think it's possible to program an assassin, for example?
Well, I know that they tried to do that. There's been books written about that. I've never read anything that indicates they were, successful. I think it's interesting that the Unabomber, it's mm-hmm. been established, I think he was part of an MKUltra program.
At Harvard?
Yeah, at Harvard. They went for the Ivy League, they went for patients in hospitals, they went for prisons. I've got a list here in a book called Operation Mind Control of all the drugs they were testing at that time for the psychological purposes. And the list is almost 140 different drugs. It wasn't just LSD. It was a long list. And yes, they were looking to do that. I'm not sure. There's been speculation about Sirhan. And I don't know that anything's been proven. I think that what's really interesting is that there's been a great evolution, I think, in the thinking of, let's say, the intelligence departments, at that time it was really the Wild West. They had these drugs that were new. They had these pretty far-out ideas, and they were choosing their guinea pigs wherever they could get them. You could answer an ad to rent an apartment. And you'd go meet with somebody who was CIA looking for guinea pigs in a mind control program. And they'd be looking for people that didn't have close family connections, that were loners, that wouldn't be noticed if they were missing for a period of time. You know, that went on. Today, I think everything has changed through because of the digital age, the internet, the spying. These days, every person carries on him the device that could enable others to spy on every aspect of his life.
In other words, it's not needed.
It's not needed. I remember there was a phase after I'd been at the Institute. You know, I went back there in 1988. I saw that the Institute had been shut down, the research department boarded up. There was a guard there, kicked me off the property. I wanted to see it after all that time. And soon after that, I ran into a fellow who claimed he was a British psychiatrist. He saw me reading a book about MKUltra, and he claimed to know a lot about it and a lot of what went on at the Neuropsychiatric Institute. And I did a taped interview with him. One of the things he talked about back in around 1988 was back then that they were encouraging everybody to buy their own telephone and have a telephone in every room. And he claimed that they were inserting little devices into the telephones so that they could listen in on any room. It wasn't a matter of turning your phone on. Your phones were always on. And that your own telephone was being used as a spy device. Right. And in those days, I thought, wow, that's pretty, you know. Do I believe that? You know, that's a pretty far-out claim. Can he prove that? He opened the telephone and he was trying to show me where the transistor was for it.
Or how about the television? Everyone had a kooky neighbor on the block who swore up and down the TV was watching them. Then it turns out, Paul, to be true.
Now it can. You know, I keep a little piece of tape over my camera lens on my computer at all times and my other devices. I'm not interested in being spied on. But in fact, today, they can know anything they want to know about you.
But the other goal of MKUltra, ostensibly, was to fracture the psyche of someone, compartmentalize the mind so that they could use that person as a mule for information. And they couldn't have access to the information that went into their own minds, but a controller at the end of the line, using some trigger word, I suppose, could access that information. I mean, I believe that still goes on.
You know, probably it could. And, you know, for me, and I encourage those who are listening to read Blowing America's Mind and really live this through reading the book as we lived it. It took me so long to really completely get over it. I think it's one of the reasons we didn't publish the book for decades. I mean, here it is, 2017, and we're talking about things that happened in the 1960s. We began writing this in the 1970s. That's why a lot of it still reads fresh. It has that the feeling of the electric Kool-Aid acid test because it's of a lot of it is of that period and when we could still capture it all. But that's what took the decades. I mean, we waited until everyone was dead. I mean, Humphrey Osmond is gone. Bernard Aronson. There's a key scene in here with the president of Princeton University at that time, Robert F. Goheen, who later became President Nixon's ambassador to India. And John Selby at that time was involved in a student committee on psychedelics. They put out a pamphlet working with one of the doctors at the infirmary about student use of psychedelics. And yes, there were warnings. I mean, at no time does I want anybody to take from this that I told them that this is safe. I'm not advocating that people go trip, and I'm not saying it's safe. Different people have different reactions to these drugs. I have a friend who, you know, smoked marijuana once, and I think one puff put him over the edge. Other people can take 500 micrograms of LSD, and it doesn't upset them psychologically. You can't predict. You don't know. But it was spreading at that time, and the university had to deal with it. And John Selby, there's a scene in the book of his conversation with President Goheen, word for word as he could remember it. And it's sort of a clash of two generations and how they felt about this. Because I think John Selby was really encouraging President Goheen at that point to take acid so that he would that he would know. He explained, you know, that the brain that we're born with has reducing valves that prevent us from being flooded with too much information, too much and the psychedelic drugs act on the diencephalon. They act on that reducing valve. And that's why 5 minutes under a psychedelic can seem like it's 5 hours, because you might normally have 100 thoughts in 5 minutes, but now you're going to have 10,000.
Right.
Or 10,000 sensations. It becomes overwhelming, and for some people, just more than they can handle. But what it does show you is that the world is much, much, much vaster than our senses let us see. We live behind a veil, and those drugs do for a short period of time, hopefully just a short period of time, they open that veil in a staggering way and show you the world new and with a new kind of depth and detail.
Short term, I get. How about a long term effect? Did it affect you long term?
I think in my case, I'm not sure I would have gone on to become a film producer had I not gone through this.
Interesting.
I had always, and you see this in the book as I talk about my story, I'd always wanted to do movies. Ever since I was a kid, I was doing amateur movies. But I never got any support for that as a profession from my family. Hmm. You know, my father was a scholar at Georgetown University.
That's right. Yeah.
He worked with John F. Kennedy, writing Profiles in Courage. He was professor to Bill Clinton in 1968. My mother was a school teacher. They felt that the sane life was you become a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher or a professor. You have a steady job. You don't go to Hollywood and say you're going to be a movie maker. Well, at some point, I abandoned my pre-medical studies at Princeton and let everybody know I am going to Los Angeles when I graduate from here. I'm going to live the life that I always wanted to live. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm going to throw my fate to the wind. And it worked out for me, Richard. It really, really worked out for me. I've made a lot of movies. I've had incredible career. You know, from the Transformers, doing all the original Transformers cartoons.
That's right, the Star Wars books.
Six Star Wars books, mm-hmm. sold millions of copies. The Transformers, 79 episodes, you know, seen by kids everywhere. And then between the movie Roswell and Jesus in India and the Sci-Fi Boys and Marilyn Monroe Declassified and the Life After Death Project and Timothy Leary's Dead and Before We Say Goodbye and The Artist and the Shaman and Starry Night, I've made all these movies. And NBC Universal picked up half of them, and they're out there. You know, to the world, I've had my say. I've been able to communicate what I felt was important, whether it's about UFOs and extraterrestrials in Roswell or Life After Death in the movie The Life After Death Project and my book, An Atheist in Heaven. So, wow, you know, they say you can't have your cake and eat it too. I had my cake. I ate it. I ate it too.
Indeed. Let me just remind listeners, Paul Jeffrey Davids is with us, the co-author, along with John Selby, of Blowing America's Mind, A True Story of Princeton CIA Mind Control, LSD, and Zen. I wanted to ask you about an experiment that was going on north of New Jersey, north and I guess a little west, and that would be that also involved
Montauk. Are you going to mention Montauk?
Well, I was actually going to mention Allen Memorial Hospital in Montreal and Dr. Ewan Cameron,
yes.
Where
psychic driving,
right? Women who ostensibly were experiencing probably postpartum depression were taken into the hospital, given massive doses, unlike your experiment, which was micro doses, massive doses of LSD, and had their memories erased and their lives ruined. And this is not, you know, hocus pocus woo woo stuff. This was settled out of court. You know, damages
years
were
later.
Paid. Yes, years later. So we know this happened. And of course, Cameron was funded by the CIA, and this was done with the complicity of the Canadian government.
You know, Richard, it's staggering. They say there were 149 different experiments under separate programs under MKUltra, and 86 different institutions. And that would be, as I said before, prisons, hospitals, universities. and maybe other organizations, but massive program where the intelligence agency felt they had the right to do this. Why? Well, because Russia was doing it. You know, Russia was studying this. But to feel that they can just take innocent civilians and use them as guinea pigs, it's what they did. These people were never told. They weren't recompensed, except in a case like the one that you cited. And tremendous damage was done. It was in the days of Richard Helms as head of the CIA. I think he came in 1964 and left in 1966. He had someone named Gottlieb working with him on supervising these experiments. This is Nazi stuff. From beginning to end, it was Nazi stuff.
Exactly. Exfiltrated all the spies, the Nazi scientists and spies into the United States for that express purpose.
Project Paperclip, they brought all the German scientists in, and then from then on, it became part of the texture of who we are. And it was out of control. It was the Wild West. Now, when it was all discovered, let me just take a step back and say it was never supposed to be discovered. It was never supposed to be released. I think Richard Helms had ordered everything burned.
It was the Church Committee, wasn't it, where they revealed this?
Yeah, that was – Ted Kennedy was involved, 1977. But these things were never burned. Someone in the CIA misfiled everything deliberately in boxes that were labeled as old financial documents that no one would be interested in. And there were boxes and boxes about all of these experiments. And they were stumbled upon, you know, about 10 years later. And it was when Stansfield Turner was head of the CIA. I mean, he said he found it abhorrent, Stansfield Turner, that this is shocking to him. He never would want the CIA to ever be involved in anything like this again. These were his declarations. Ted Kennedy promising the American people, never again. This is part of the past. Okay, maybe it's part of the past.
Maybe.
We don't know.
Officially, MKUltra was supposed to be shut down in 1973, but I mean, I have my doubts.
You know why my book was rejected the first time around? There was an editor who said, you know, you were part of this program in 1967, but MKUltra was shut down in, I think he said, 1963 or 1964, so it couldn't have been part of MKUltra. It was nonsense. Nonsense. Yes, it went on. Yes, the names of the doctors we were connected with, including Carl Pfeiffer, who had his affiliation with Princeton University. He had the Princeton Brain Research Center. I mean, Richard, we waited until everyone died, even Robert Goheen, the former president of Princeton. You know, the air was clear, and John Selby and I said, look, we're not young anymore. Let's put this number one in our bucket list. Let's finish the book this year. Let's get it out there and just see what happens, because it's true. Let people know. Most of my career, I never talked about this. People who worked with me on movies, they never knew that I was part of this. I wanted to leave this program really far behind me, and I'm quite sure I got over it. But this is the point in our life where we said, hey, you know, we've got to publish it, and I hope people are going to be there to read it, because I want to share it with the world.
Paul, I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you so much. Congratulations to you and John Selby on Blowing America's Mind, a true story of Princeton, CIA mind control, LSD, and Zen. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Good night.
Good night.
That's quite a story. College kids as guinea pigs in the CIA's mind control experiments. I want to give you a heads up on what's coming up on episode 5 of Conspiracy Unlimited. But first, let me ask you, have you heard about this free guide you can download that contains a list of online power tools to make you more efficient, secure, even boost your income? Best of all, this online toolbox guide is absolutely free. How do you get it?
simply visit freebusinesstoolbox.com to grab your copy while they last. This guide has some of the very same online tools that successful business owners use every day, and each one is highly recommended. I know. There are websites out there that will offer a special giveaway like this, but then they want to stick you into a recurring program or some other deal. But this isn't like that. There's no hidden thing to try, no credit card needed, no cost whatsoever. BrightBiz is literally giving away this online toolbox guide completely free as a means of putting their best foot forward. But this is a limited time offer, so grab your free guide today and take your business and your income to the next level. Visit freebusinesstoolbox.com to get your free guide to 36 online power tools. That address again, freebusinesstoolbox.com. Coming up on Episode 5 of Conspiracy Unlimited, President Donald Trump has made an historic decision to formally recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and move the U.S. Embassy to the Eternal City. Will these moves lead to a path to peace or further chaos in the Middle East? What's the future of America and Israel in these prophetic times? My guest, best-selling author of Gods and Thrones, Carl Gallups. Until next time, I'm Richard Serrett. So long for now.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need constant petting.